Welcome to the Man Up, Man Down podcast, presented by Volker Baluda and David Pawsey. We discuss the pressures and challenges faced by men approaching middle age that we're often too embarrassed to speak about with our friends. You can find us online at www.manupdown.com. Enjoy the show and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review.
So, welcome to another episode of Men Up, Men Down. I'm very honoured and very excited, actually. I don't often get nervous interviewing people, but we welcome Jerry Colonna on the podcast. So I've known off Jerry as the coach with a spider tattoo. So he was on Tim Ferriss's podcast, and we just established it was in 2019. And Ian Saunders, who was on our podcast previously, and he will also be coming back, is a friend of Jerry's. And I noticed that on LinkedIn. I'm like, is there a chance for an intro? It's like, you know, what one of the few heroes I have in life. So Jerry, great to have you on the podcast. As in form of an introduction, let me read out a little bit of an intro. So Jerry is a leading executive coach who uses the skills he learned as a venture capitalist to help entrepreneurs. He's a co-founder and CEO of Reboot, the executive coaching and leadership development company, host of the Reboot podcast, and also of two books, Reunion, Leadership and the Longing to Belong, and Reboot, Leadership and the Art of Growing Up. He draws on his wide variety of experience to help clients design a more conscious life and make needed changes to their career to improve their performance and satisfaction. Previously, he was a partner with JP Morgan Partners, the private equity arm of JP Morgan Chase. He joined JP Morgan Partners from Flatiron Partners, which he launched in 1996 with partner Fred Wilson. And Flatiron became one of the most successful early stage investment programs in the New York City area. And he now lives on a farm in Longmont, Colorado. Jerry, I'm so excited. Welcome to our podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. And listening to you read that reminds me of how old I am. So 1996. Oh boy, that was a long time ago. But anyway, yes, it's great to be here with you both.
Thank you.
In 1996, I graduated from high school, just to put that.
See, that's what I mean. You see how freaking old I am? My joke when I do public talks, my joke is, you know, I do a lot of talks for entrepreneurs and things like that. And it's like, yeah, you know, I invented the internet in 1994, you know, when you were in middle school, you know, and then somebody raised their hand and said, I was in primary school. Shut up.
I know. I mean, I feel old, you know, if I say similar to yourself, not at the same level. I work, you know, as a coach, but I also work as an advisor with companies. And, you know, some of the startups, I'm going like, you were born 2000 when? You know, it's like, what? You know, it's, exactly. Yeah, it's crazy. It's unstoppable. So, Jerry, where do we want to start? Do you want to give us an overview? I mean, I don't know where you want to start, but, you know, talk about the spider tattoo. I'd love to. So I have in my memory that you were on psychedelics when you found a spider.
Everybody thinks there were no psychedelics involved.
Okay. So tell me how you got to it. So maybe I make that up. So I'm glad we clarified. Yeah,
I saw Volker sold it to me. It's like he's going to come on and talk about psychedelics.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. So just to be clear, that's in psychological terms, that's called wish fulfillment. And you want to do psychedelics, and you want to talk to a spider.
Maybe I was on psychedelics.
All right. Well, stop laughing and make this a coherent narrative. What you're referring to is a story that I do tell in my first book, Reboot, but that Tim Ferriss surfaced and then dubbed me the coach with the spider tattoo. And unfortunately or fortunately, we're not recording video, so I can't show you all the tattoo, but I still have it, right? It's above my heart. And I think it's relevant even to the purpose of this show in some ways, because my encounter with the spider, which is memorialized in the tattoo, occurred as part of my midlife journey. If we teleport way back 15, 16, 17 years ago, I was, like a lot of folks in their 40s, a fucking mess. I was just trying to figure out, like, who I was, what my life was, you know. It followed a period of enormous external success in being, as you noted, an early stage venture capitalist and being very successful in the first Web 1.0 iteration. And then all of that came crashing down like a house of cards. And the simplistic way of understanding it was that I came to understand that the internal me and the external me were crosswise with each other. And so the more success I had externally, the worse I actually felt, which is a bit of a mindfuck, isn't it? Because we are socialized, especially in our 20s and 30s, to believe that the path to happiness lays in accumulation of stuff, wealth, approbation, affirmation. Look at me, I just got promoted, you know, this like upward mobility kind of construct. And as I often describe it, there's a metaphor that I will use, which is, you know, those of us on a merry-go-round, well, when they were first developed, you would reach out and grab a ring. And if you got a ring, you could trade it in for a prize. Well, I had the brass ring in my hand, and I was still miserable. Okay, so fast forward. I then went on this profound journey of several years where I did an incredible amount of internal work. I had always been in therapy, especially from my early 30s. I continued to be in therapy, but I began a period of real seeking. And that seeking included doing a retreat with a guy named Bill Plotkin from Animus Valley Institute. He still does this work. And I had read a book called Soulcraft, which I highly recommend. It's still available. And there was a Soulcraft retreat. And so I went on this retreat, a real mess, not knowing who I was and what I wanted to do with my life and what the hell was going on. And for context, I was married. I have three children. They were younger than they are now. And so I go on this retreat, and one night we are doing what's called a trance dance. So again, no psychedelics involved.
Okay.
Okay?
Noted.
but there was an out-of-body state induced simply by the act of dancing. And we're dancing in a circular motion. It's an indigenous dance, and we are exhausted. And I stumble into bed, and I have this intense dream. And in the dream, I am driving a car with my three children to a beach house that is completely white. And the kids are really excited. And I've got this like foreboding, something bad is going to happen. And we get to the house and the kids run out of the car and they're super excited because they're at the beach house. And I go into the basement of this house, and the house is completely white. And I go into the basement of this house and the floor is covered with mushrooms. Again, I did not ingest any mushrooms.
That's probably where I got it from.
That's where you got it.
Must have.
Right. And so as I'm looking at the mushrooms, I get really afraid. And I see the mushrooms as symbolic of rot in the house. And again, to understand dream interpretation, the house is me. It's the psychic house of me. And instead of, well, the reaction I have is I pull all the mushrooms up by their roots And I scream at the kids, let's get out, get out, get out. And then I wake up. The next morning after the dream, I tell this dream in circle with Bill. And Bill says to me, leave the room. Go out into the forest. Go find those mushrooms and apologize to them. And ask them, what was the message that you were too afraid to hear? And I leave the room and I start muttering to myself, what the fuck am I doing? I'm 42 years old. I'm walking in a forest looking for mushrooms to have a conversation. Okay.
As you do.
As you do. And I look down at my feet are the exact same mushrooms that I dreamed about. And I start crying. And I say to the mushrooms, what are you here to tell me? And the mushrooms say to me, go to your spot. Now, for context, this retreat was in a forest, and we had each found a spot in the woods where we would spend nights in solitude. So I go to my spot. I'm kind of shaking. I'm exhausted. I have no idea what's happening to me. And I sit down and, you know, I wrap my arms around my knees and I look over to my right and there's this glistening spider web with a spider on it. And I'm like, okay, what the fuck is going on here? And I say to the spider, kind of in a surrender moment, what are you here to tell me? And the spider says to me, you worry too much. The children are going to be okay. And I just burst into tears. And so I got the tattoo to never, ever forget that A, I worry too much, and B, that my children are going to be okay. And I'll bring it all the way back to midlife. For me, I was at a moment in time where the entire house of cards that I had constructed that defined who I was actually needed to come down. And the thing that was preventing me from allowing the thing that needed to happen was my projection onto my children that this was a disaster that was going to befall them. P.S. the way the story ends, the epilogue, my kids are fine. They're totally fucking fine. They're adults. My oldest is 33 now. Guess what he's looking forward to, right? He'll be listening to the podcast soon. But the truth of that spider was I worried too much. And what did I worry? I worried about whether or not I was a good father. I wrote about this in chapter 9 of Reboot. Ultimately, whether or not I was a good man. Right, because that's what it boils down to. Am I a good man? It's a haunting question, isn't it? So now I'll shut up.
I mean, I was just going to say, like, of all the things to worry about, how your children are, I guess, the thing, you know, the best thing to worry about. So, you know, it's like, well, yeah, who doesn't worry about their children? I guess that's almost a survival instinct, isn't it? Protecting the next generation.
Sure. You can go at it from an evolutionary psychology perspective and say, what am I really doing? I'm protecting my DNA. And yet that's not what it's about. Right? To me, in chapter 9 of Reboot, I tell the story. I open that chapter by talking about coming upon this toppled over oak tree and musing that this oak tree is now at the end of its life and seeing and projecting into that oak tree a full life with branches stretched by acts of kindness and gnarls and scars in the wood resulting from selfishness, not living up to aspirational values and realizing that I, at the end of my days, will be like that tree. And that there's parts of me to celebrate. There are parts of me that I am damn proud of. And there are parts of me that I feel shame about. And there are parts of me that wishes it could, I could have done it differently. But that the totality of that is a good man or a good adult. Because over time, I grew into my purpose, which is to shelter and be a service to other people, including my children.
Deep, very deep.
I've never been accused of being shallow.
I can see that. If I say, don't take that the wrong way, it's a typical journey a midlife man goes through, right? You're getting to this stage where you have void, where you don't know, you know, what you're doing in life. Is it the right thing? Is it the wrong thing? I mean, you talked earlier about, you know, happiness as being, you know, the wealth you accumulate. I mean, I used to have the sports car, right? I sold it again for various reasons. We don't need to go into detail. And I got my first tattoo in midlife. I got my first tattoo in 2020. My wife says I'm covered now. And I'm like, no, I still have space on my legs. So, you know, I'm not covered. If I say these are the things we do as midlife men. So you obviously had a very successful career beforehand. When you found your purpose, what changed?
Well, I would, let's give some more context to that. I think I have a very successful career after that too, but it's a very different career. And so what comes to mind is an old Buddhist aphorism, which is, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Before midlife, chop wood, carry water. After midlife, chop wood, carry water. Everything's the same and everything is different. And that is baffling. And I think part of the experience, looking back, I'm now 60, okay? So I'm an old fuck. I think part of the experience that folks have as they're entering that period of transition, you know, our friend Chip Conley would call it a midlife chrysalis, where he describes this sort of transition. Part of that fear is the fear of not knowing what is happening to me. And the very human tendency to want to hold on to things just as they are. It's like if we could preserve moments in amber, our children, our career, our highlights, if we could just stay frozen, then we don't have to be afraid. But of course, the only thing that freezes us in moment is death. Because otherwise, everything else is change. And so the fear of the uncertainty that, say, midlife represents is actually a fear of life unfolding exactly the way it's supposed to unfold. And what I have learned, and I think I feel comfortable saying I'm on the other side of that transition now, entering what I call elderhood. The fear is, just like the spider taught me, the fear is that everything is going to fall apart and everything good about my life is going to disappear. And I can tell you, as kind of an older brother, further down the path, it's going to be fine.
Hello, it's Volker here. I hope you enjoy this episode. You might not realize that I have been coaching for almost a decade through both third parties and private clients. During that time, I've worked with brands such as General Electric, Imperial Brands, DHL, and Pepsi. However, This year, I'm putting a big emphasis on growing my private coaching practice, improving lives of middle-aged men in leadership positions. So if you hit midlife transition point and you might be a bit stuck or looking to improve your work-life balance, your career, or productivity, you want to build a new habit, or you just want to become a better version of yourself, please hit me up. You can reach me on Volker@Obnatus, that's Volker@obnat.us, or on LinkedIn, whatever is easiest. Thanks, and now back to the episode.
Well, I mean, you sort of talked about sort of being successful in your 30s, and you also said, well, I've had a successful career now, or, you know, my second career has also been successful. Has your definition of success changed? I mean, this is, you know, a rhetorical question, because I'm guessing, you know, you know, it's sort of when you're younger, a lot of the time success is materialism and, you know, money in the bank. But yeah, anyway, I'll let you answer the question, Jerry.
Well, you already know the answer, right? And I suspect you know the answer, David, because you're going through that whole transformation yourself. I mean, why the heck do you guys do a podcast on midlife if it's not for yourselves, ultimately, right? And yes, the first stage of my career, the first stage of my adulthood, I would call it, it somewhat was the accumulation. But as I detail quite specifically in Reboot, my first book, it was the accumulation in order to feel safe. You know, I grew up food insecure. I grew up with enormous poverty. I grew up with enormous violence as a child. It was a false belief, a belief fed to me by society, that in order to feel safe now and forever, in order to make sure that my children were safe now and forever, that the accumulation of toys, the accumulation of things, the accumulation of status would ward off all of the bad things from happening. And it was really the realization that I had the brass ring, I had all the things, and I still felt unsafe.
And then you're worrying about, what have I done to my children?
Exactly.
To give them, yeah.
That's right. That's wow. Right. So my current definition of quote-unquote success, I would argue, it continues to be fluid, but it, you know, right there, I'm in my New York office, there's a framed quote from Suzuki Roshi that says, to find the meaning of your life is to find the meaning of your everyday activity. Now, what is Suzuki Roshi saying with that? What he's saying is success is not measured at the end of your life by the accumulation of toys. Success is measured, or purpose and meaning are measured, by how you feel each day and how you make the people around you feel every day, which is both simplistic and profound.
So if you hadn't been so financially successful at an earlier age, do you think, is wealth, does that allow you to then move on to that next stage? Whereas if you're on, you know, on a bit of a treadmill, you know, it's like, you know, yeah, if you're working 12 hours a day doing like manual labor, which, you know, I don't do, it's... You know, I mean, like, I sort of feel me and Volker are in a privileged position to be able to sort of contemplate these things. And it's like, well, actually, you know, some guys don't sort of get the breath to do that almost.
Yeah. You know, David, I think you're raising a really important point. And the point has to do with an inquiry into the privilege, if you will, that, you know, I'll name it, as a white, as someone who identifies as white, cisgender, straight, and male, and the power and privilege that can come from that, is it self-indulgent, for example, to be able to contemplate these things. You're right in the sense that, you know, at 38, when I walked away from my career as a venture capitalist, I did have enough money in the bank that for several years, I did not worry about income. And that is a privilege that is an expression of a systemic inequality that exists in all of our societies, manifesting in different ways. And that is true. And there are plenty of people who do not experience that financial well-being, who embark on these kinds of questions. And there are plenty of people who have far more resources than I will ever have who do not embark on these questions. And so while there is a relationship, it is not necessarily causative. And the best example of that is we all, whether experiencing through third parties or directly, know of people who could do that inner exploration work and for whatever reason choose not to. And the worst of them are those who hold power. They might control, for example, a major social media network as well as a satellite internet access network. Okay? Who choose not to look inward and as a result spread toxicity, spread the discontent and disease that is within them around the world. Some of them even get elected president of the United States.
Hopefully only once.
May God hear your pleas. But seen through the lens of what we're talking about, can you see the pain and suffering that they must be experiencing? Which does not excuse the pain and suffering they inflict. They are still responsible, even though I can feel empathy for their inner turmoil. My challenge to them, and this is, you know, turning 60, this is a thing that I'm going to spend a lot of the next few years focused on. My challenge to people who are in that position is, in effect, going back to the first book, Reboot, grow the fuck up. Get your shit together. Do your work so that you don't inflict damage on people around you. Your partners, your colleagues, your employees, your children. Do your work. By the way, it will make you happier. But you have a moral responsibility to do that work.
Well, I've got two questions. A, do some of the the theoretical people that you've mentioned, do you think there is pain there, or do you think they're, you know, then they're so unaware of themselves? But also, I mean, you know, it's sort of we seem to be at sort of, well, we are at like a major sort of time in history with AI, digital technology, etc., etc. Then, you know, there's sort of people like yourselves that trying to spread a message of hope and, well, taking responsibility for yourself. I mean, you know, which way do you think it is going to go? Are you hopeful for the future, or are you scared for the future?
I think there's a false dichotomy in your question. One can be both frightened and hopeful. Let me go back to your first observation. Look, as a Buddhist, every morning I sit in meditation and I repeat part of my bodhisattva vow. And to recall, a bodhisattva is someone who has the potential to be enlightened, to escape what's called samsara, the endless cycle of suffering that is life, and to not end up being reborn, but chooses to take rebirth until all beings are free of suffering. Now, implicit in the Bodhisattva vow is the fundamental belief of the second noble truth, which is that life is filled with suffering, the first noble truth. And the hypothetical folks, the archetypes that I was speaking to, of course they're filled with suffering. Indeed, I would argue that the number of true sociopaths, people who have no feeling sense, is actually quite rare. And that's really critical. And I want to acknowledge that there's a radiator making steaming noises over the side. So forgive everybody. And this is really important part of the second half of your question and my response to that. The recognition of the predominance of suffering does not turn me into hopeless. Because the second noble truth is that the closest we get, the more we do to push away suffering increases suffering. It's the truth of attachment. The third noble truth is that there is a way out. And the way out is the Eightfold Path. And so when I think about this, and this brings me, in a sense, to Reunion, my new book. Reunion attempts to look at the suffering caused by the divisiveness in our societies. It's all of that inward radical self-inquiry that I wrote about in Reboot turned outward to say, for example, how have I been complicit in and benefited from the conditions in the world I say I don't want to see? Which is a really harsh question. It's a difficult question to ask. And it immediately can invoke all sorts of defensiveness. But the truth is that particular kind of suffering persists for reasons. And I would argue that part of the reason it persists is that those of us who have power and privilege, who have not done our work, unconsciously or sometimes consciously, maintain the divisiveness. I mean, again, if we want to talk about a theoretical presidential candidate in the United States, okay, who will use terms like vermin to describe migrants, which, by the way, include my ancestors.
Includes most people's ancestors in the U.S.
Yeah. or will refer to bloodbath as a consequence of him not getting his own way. Okay. The maintenance of fear of the other person manifested in what the scholar John A. Powell would call systemic othering is a consequence of his not confronting his own woundedness, his own brokenness. Now, you could sort of argue, well, is there a personality disorder, that structure and all that? And that all may be true. But the hope lies in this, David. The hope lies in the willingness to confront what does not work. Either at the individual level, which arguably is what the call to midlife is all about, or at the societal level. And if we confront what is not working with empathy and compassion, then we have a possibility of real transformation. I fundamentally, wholeheartedly believe that. Because to believe otherwise is nihilistic. We might as well just build walls around each of our houses and order from food delivery services and never see each other.
Great.
Hope stems from empathy.
Man Up, Man Down is sponsored by Welldoing. As someone who has seen a counsellor for a number of years, I think their approach is great. They want you to find the mental health professional who is right for you. You can filter your search to highlight therapists with expertise where you need it, or you can pay to use their personalised matching service. The people who run Welldoing are experts in mental well-being, and they also have loads of posts and interviews to keep your mental health in good shape. Take a look at welldoing.org.
I'm listening in awe. There are a few things I'd like to pick up on. I really like how you phrased, or framed, I shall say, midlife as a fear of life, right?
The uncertainty and discomfort that arises at midlife is the fear of life. Midlife itself is not the fear of life.
No, sorry. And that this... So I have several thoughts around that. So one is, it explains to me, and if I say we talk a lot on the podcast about, you know, suicide rates and men being the highest around 42.
Yeah.
Because people are afraid, right? They're anxious of what might or might not come. And we always say, you know, if we can prevent one, our job is done, right? If we can prevent one suicide. The other thing, how you framed it as well, is it's almost, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but if you can go through midlife and face your fears and your inner demons, right? I think that's how you describe it as well. You come out on the other end and you almost have a second life, right? You have whether you continue in the path you were on before, but most likely on a different, more fulfilling path that leads to more happiness because you're less driven by, say, external validation, but more by internal validation. That's how I piece it together in my head. But you wrote two books on it. I mean, which book should I read first?
I would read Reboot first, because it lays out the fundamental call to action for our own individual work. And that is a basis for Reunion, which again takes that inner lens and points it outward. But I want to go back to the way you were describing things. And I think from the vantage point of where I am now, I might alter a little bit and reframe a little bit of what you were saying. I'm not sure, first of all, having dealt with suicidal feelings two major times in my life. The first time I acted upon them, and I was 18, and I tried to kill myself and ended up in a hospital for 3 months and set me on a particular path. And then the second time was at 38, which was at that period in which prior to my encounter with the spider, for me, it wasn't as much about the fear of what was happening as much as a kind of, the French word ennui comes to mind, which is this kind of deadening feeling of, is that all there is? That's it? I've worked my ass off for this? I kind of got sold a bill of goods, which then spiraled me into a depression. And I think that this is an important point, because the other side of what we're talking about, and for those who are sort of beginning this journey, let me point the way a little bit to what the end of the journey looks like. The end of the journey is not happiness. The end of the journey is wholeness. And that's an important distinction, because part of the bill of goods that we are sold is, if you do everything right, you go to the right schools, you get the right job, you work really hard, you do this, you are going to be happy forever and ever and ever and ever. And the ennui that kicks in is, what the fuck? How come I'm not? There must be something wrong with me. Okay. So it's anger plus this like nagging dissatisfaction that then leads to giving up. And the antidote to sadness isn't happiness, it's wholeness. And I'll give you a quote that manifests this. Carl Jung said, the whole man, and he's making a gendered comment, so let's reframe it, the whole human is not just one who has walked with God, but is someone who has wrestled with the devil. See, this is the ultimate cheat code in the video game of life. You have to do the thing that is counterintuitive. You have to walk into the dark places and ask yourself, why is this place dark?
Was that the phrase, the gold is in the cave that you fear to go in?
Joseph Campbell said, the treasure you seek is in the back of the cave.
Thank you. That's what I was trying to say.
Okay. Way in the fucking back where it's dark and scary. Because, you know, Volker, you talk about the depression and suicide rates. Part of what I think propels depression, and we both know that it's the number one cause of death for men between 35 and 60 years old. Part of what happens is that they have not been socialized to know what to do with those feelings. And the Buddhists teach us what to do with those feelings. It's compassion. Etymologically, the word compassion breaks down into calm, to be with, passion, feelings. The counterintuitive expression, the thing that goes against the entire capitalist structure, which would say, buy a new car, wear really good deodorant, maybe take Rogaine so your hair doesn't fall out. The counterintuitive move is to be with the really difficult feelings. Because that's the path to wholeness. And if you can practice that resiliency, when the shit hits the fan, because it always will, what happens for me is when the depression comes back, because it comes back every year, my capacity to lift myself up and self-soothe is much stronger than it's ever been. And so, therefore, I'm happier than I've been in the past. Does that make sense? What I laid out there?
Makes perfect sense. As a student of psychotherapy, we just covered depression and suicide last weekend of the course. So what would be your advice? What would it be if you know, if someone middle-aged listening to the podcast goes like, I hear you, Jerry. What you're saying all makes sense. This is great stuff. What should I do tomorrow to change my life? Or what should I do today to face my demons, to go to the dark place, to find the gold? Should I go into therapy? Should I start meditating? Should I start running a marathon?
I'll answer it this way, Volker.
Yeah.
Last week I was doing a public talk. I did a fireside chat and book reading from my new book, Reunion. And there were a variety of people in the audience. And there was one young man who's about 25 years old. And the day after the talk, we had set up for a book signing so people could come and chat and get a book signed. And he came up to me with tears in his eyes. And he kind of asked his own version of that question. He asked... the way he framed it was, how can I be more actualized? And what he was getting at is something that's very, very common for folks that age and into their 30s. Should I meditate every day? Should I journal every day? Should I do psilocybin? Should I, you know, go into therapy? Should I do this, 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 this? And the wish for that answer is really heartfelt. I could feel, what does he want? And what does he really want? What he really wanted, Volker, was to not feel broken. And so rather than giving him the answer, I did something really frustrating. And I said, what if you're already actualized? And the reason that that comes to mind is that if someone is listening, to play out the scenario that you described, if somebody's listening and says, this all makes sense, Jerry, what should I do? The first step would be to understand that you're not broken. You just feel broken. And I can't tell you how enormously liberating that perspective is. If you're not broken, then the things that you need to do really are about going to the back of the cave, David, and realizing that there is a treasure there. The second thing to do, and if you're listening to this show, you already know this to be true. No matter how you feel, you're not alone. Because one of the worst things we do in our society to people who are suffering is we inadvertently and unconsciously and unintentionally exacerbate the feeling that they're the only one. So, I'm broken, and I'm the only one. And just for extra dose of helping, what we often feel is, and I'm the worst one. Okay? So now I'm going to get into a different posture. This is what I would call my elder posture, which I'm trying on and feeling really good about. You are not alone. Others have come before you. We have survived. You will survive. You will survive. And it's going to take work. And after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. You still have your work to do as a human being. From that place, yeah, exercises that help you do self-reflection, read poetry, go dance, hike in the woods, meditate, sit in meditation, walking meditation, do journaling practices, listening to podcasts, read really good books, buy lots of copies of Jerry's books, give them out to your friends. All of these things can help. But the most important shift is the mindset shift. I'm not broken. I'm just in pain. Does that answer your question?
It does answer my question. And it's, to be honest, I think that's what people need to hear as well.
Yeah.
I mean, one question that I had, and it sort of follows on from sort of conversation that we had earlier about feeling old, and you know, the Volker mentioned about working with you know, startup founders that, you know, were born in this millennium, and you've talked about sort of being an elder, and we had a guest on. They work with young adults that are approaching like legal manhood, that haven't had the best start in lives. And sort of the way that they explained it was like, well, you know, you've got, it's almost providing is probably not the best word, but it's, you know, passing on this advice from, you know, beautifully flawed men that have fucked it all up and come out the other side. and then are like, right, I'll, you know, I want to pass this advice on. I mean, do you think that have we almost lost touch with that sort of that wisdom of older generations, because we're always in pursuit of finding the new thing and the quickest way to do something rather than going back to basics? And that feels like an incredibly complicated open question.
Well, I think you already know the answer, don't you? Because, you know, at base, what you're asking is, have we lost touch with that? In reunion, I argue that one of the pathways to overcoming the separation that divides us is to look to our ancestors and turn them into elders. And I would argue that it is the elders of our societies who are the holders of the wisdom. And that disconnect, I don't think, by the way, it's a recent phenomenon. I'm not of the ilk who would say, well, it's all TikTok's fault or it's all Facebook's fault. The truth is, we destroy our elders time and time again. It's part of this human condition. To access what your guest was describing, I think is really important. One of the gifts that I feel right now, and you can hear it even in my voice and in my language, by allowing myself to embrace my elderhood, what I'm doing is I'm embracing the life that is implicit in transition and aging. And what it's doing for me is it's giving me new energy, a kind of revitalized experience to realize that rather than just dying, that like the oak tree, my job is to shelter those who are coming behind me and assure them that they're going to be okay. And every now and then I might slap them upside the head and say, sit up straight, stop being a jerk, be kind. But ultimately, if we see this transition period not as the dying of the old, but as preparation for the elderhood, boy, talk about giving meaning and purpose. And I think I wandered completely from your question, but...
I mean, what are you describing? And you mentioned Chip earlier. That's Chip's work, right? Chip Conley.
Right.
The elderly. If I say the elderly stuff, I'm not there yet. Yeah. I'm still in midlife.
Yeah. it's very funny. Chip and I have circled each other through mutual friends for several years. And then shortly after I turned 60 in December, I got an email from him. And then we ended up on a call, and the essence of the message was the Council of Elders is calling you. I said, did you know that I turned 60? That's going down. But, you know, that mindset enables me to connect to younger people. So, for example, in reunion, there's a chapter in there where I talk about my relationship with my father, or more specifically, coming to understand more deeply what his journey was like, which was a necessary component of my own movement through this midlife period. Again, what does it mean to be a good man? Who was my first model of what a man was? My father, right? So I wrote this book, and there's a line in there where I quote Tennessee Williams' psychiatrist in conversation with Tennessee Williams. And the psychiatrist said to him, you'll begin to forgive the world when you've begun to forgive your father. Oh, yeah. You okay, David?
Yeah. No, that's, that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we just got a window into David's childhood. So thank you for that. I got you, buddy. Okay, you have to read Reunion and then you have to write to me. Okay. So But this young man who's 22 wrote to me, and we got on a phone call, and he was just all in tears. He's like, I can't forgive my father. I said, start with understanding him. Start asking yourself questions like, how has this ancestor, how did he get to be the way he was? What happened in his life? You know, in my father's life, he was adopted at age 18 months. And so for the first 18 months of his life, he was William Michael Heffernan, the son of a 20-year-old Irish immigrant, poor in New York, whose father disowned him. And then at 18 months, he became Jerome Vito Colonna, the child of Italian-American immigrants. And he found out about this on his fucking wedding day, when the woman he knew as his mother, so angry with him for getting married to my mother, stood at the back of the church and screamed, "Putana, putana, putana, whore, 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 you're not my son. You were adopted." And feeling that enabled me to understand his lifelong depression as it manifested in alcoholism.
So did he tell you this, or is this sort of something that you found retrospectively?
No, this was used by my mother as a weapon against him.
Right.
My father never talked about it. So we grew up with this knowledge. But it was only 30 years after his death that I reconnected with it. And I'll do a spoiler alert. I ended up in Ireland at the gravesite of his biological mother to tell her what her son was like and what her grandchildren were like. That's the last chapter of the book.
Wow.
Jerry, this is great. If I say it's helpful, and I hope the listeners see it equally. If nothing else, it's a lot of food for thought. And of course, a reason to buy your books. So,
well, and to give lots of gifts of them. Maybe we'll close with this. We all have a reunion to do. Part of the reason to do that is because what ails the world. But part of the reason that we need to reunite with the dismembered parts of ourselves, the forgotten parts of our family tree, is so that we can be whole. Midlife is an ideal time to embark on the reunion process. To go back in time and say, what happened to? What were they feeling? What was their experience like? And how has that shown up in my life? So that I can then be whole and participate in a healing process for others. Do you feel the hopefulness in that?
And I think everyone in midlife is going through that. And if I say needs to, should go through that. Because if you don't heal yourself, you can't, as you say, heal the world, right?
Amen.
I was about to say that, and I thought I better don't, but you said it first. Jerry, this was amazing. And whilst we often say that to guests, I'd love to have you back. I took lots of notes. And I openly admit I haven't read all your books yet. I've read summaries. I will now.
Well, let's make a deal. You both have to read at least one of the books.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back and we'll have
a Yeah, and talk exactly. about that sounds like an awesome idea.
Yeah. Because this is deep and this is useful. And I think, to be honest, for me, as I said, I'm in awe after listening to your conversation with Tim years ago, but this brings it home, right? This is the stuff. I mean, we haven't talked about me, but for me, there's so many connection points from Buddhism, therapy, healing, midlife, tattoos. There's so many you know, things where I just relate in my head and I want to put it together. And I'm sure that there will be lots of listeners out there that are sitting here now going like, shit, I need to start connecting the dots to become more whole, essentially.
That's right. That's the work of your life.
Yeah. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was amazing.
You got it.
Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Feel free to reach out to Volker or David via our website, www.manupdown.com, or podcast@manupdown.com, with any feedback or to let us know what topics you'd like us to cover in the future. Hear you again soon.